Blog Talk Radio.
Broadcasting to the world. Broadcasting to the world.
BlakeRadio.com. Music for your mind, body, and soul. Talk radio at its best. You're listening to Rainbow Soul from BlakeRadio.com.
Listen to Africana Studies with Professor Manu M. Pim on the BlakeRadio.com network, and I'm calling from Oakland, California. And on this program, I'll be looking at the revolutionary Martin Luther King. Now, this is a timely topic because every year there's a national and even international focus on Dr. King by the mainstream media, the general public, and people from all walks of life. But for the most part, King is completely misrepresented by most. And the reason for this systematic misrepresentation of Dr. King's work and his philosophy is because his image, his legacy, has been seized by the mainstream media, by writers, historians, and in some cases there's this distortion. And the seizing of his legacy has taken place by former colleagues as well and people who were active in the 50s and 60s. So my task over the next 90 minutes is to present the revolutionary Dr. King. Now, my work goes back to the 1980s when I decided to write a master's thesis on the revolutionary Dr. Martin Luther King. And what led me to that master's thesis project was the fact that I had a book called A Testament of Hope that was given to me by my mentor, Brother Walimu Gary Ware, and the students in the organization that I had founded, the Progressive Students Action Committee. So they gave that to me as a gift, and I was very surprised at reading the essays and writings and interviews that were done and King's statements, because the statements that I had read and articles and excerpts that I had read in that book were stunning. They were in stunning contradiction to the public image of him as an abstract dreamer. So that was one issue. And also I had a tape or two of King who was spitting fire in regards to his criticism of the American domestic policy and American international and foreign policy. So I decided back in 1987 to embrace the project of looking at King to help liberate his legacy. And I had the opportunity to just do the minimal, do work at Morgan State University's library, which is one of the most important libraries in the state of Maryland regarding the experience of black people in America. But I decided to go beyond the Morgan State Library and go to the archives, go to the original records, interview activists at the time who were prominent during the era of Dr. King. So I decided to make a contribution for the ages to help liberate his legacy. So rather than being an average person and having average information about Dr. King, I decided to go to the sources, to go to the record and go deeper. Because if Dr. King was simply a dreamer and he just wanted to have black people and white people hold hands and sing We Shall Overcome, if that was the extent of his work and his vision, then certainly he would not have become the most targeted and the most surveillance person in the history of America. And certainly J. Edgar Hoover, the head of the FBI, and William Sullivan, right under Hoover, those men would have not seen Dr. King as a threat to the American political order. They would not have seen him as the greatest, the most dangerous, they called him the most dangerous black man in America. They made that determination as early as 1963. If King was simply a dreamer, I asked, why was there a systematic Get King campaign from 62 to his assassination in 1968? And so the surveillance on Dr. King was so tight that he couldn't even wiggle. So this is what led me to really examine the real issues. And as I did that, I found that it was important to not only look at his birthday, going back in January 15, 1929, but his death day. What were the issues, the factors that led to the assassination of Dr. King back on April 4, 1968? So this is a program where I'm going to share some of these ideas and really give you an update, because it's clear that Dr. King is one of the most distorted figures in the history of America. I argued he's the most misrepresented and the most understood and distorted person in the history of the country, because he's one of the most popular figures, and people are quite aware of maybe a couple of his speeches, maybe one or so of his writings, but they're not aware. They're not aware of the depth, the breadth of his work, as Dr. King worked for 12 and a half years as one of the greatest political activists in the history of America, but that is now lost on the American public. The public is not aware of the real Dr. King. What we have is Dr. King, the myth. So we want to explode that today. And maybe the last 30 minutes of the program, for those that want to call in, we'll take calls and we'll have a dialogue, and I'll give you that call-in number later. But let's first lay some groundwork, because it's been my experience over the many years that there are always a group of people, no matter what you tell them, they say it ain't so, it can't be so, that can't be true. So they will take an oppositional position regarding the real King that emerged when we share that with the public, and they want to keep him in this fantasy land. They want to keep him frozen in the old concept of I Had a Dream, and yet separate him from some of the most important work that he did on the American scene to help change the political landscape of America, the economic landscape to some degree. And they say it ain't so, but the same individuals who say that they can't be so, that we're just making up modern-day ideas about Dr. King, these are the same individuals who have not read a single word. They've not read a single word by Dr. King. They don't know what his philosophy was. They don't know what his program was. They can't tell you anything that he's written. These are the people who don't even know that Dr. King wrote 5 books. They've never read any of his essays. All they know is only a portion of the I Have a Dream speech. They don't even know the first part of the speech, or the first 2/3 of it. So it's kind of amazing that people will say it ain't so, and yet they've done no research. So I challenge people to always recognize that documentation beats conversation every day of the week. So we can never underestimate the value of going to the sources, those sources in the archives around the country, those sources representing represented by his former colleagues, as well as other people who are active in the movement, their observations, their comments, not only at the time but since the assassination of King. All of these factors must be looked at. So we must always go to the source so we can get beyond hearsay and uninformed opinion. And it's interesting that even when we've had informed historians who have written about the work of King and his legacy, his political philosophy, there's been great distortions. These distortions are quite amazing when we look at the specific records, and then we contrast these records to what historians have been presenting to the American public. So let's first start by looking at some of the sources, because we must always start there. As a trained historian, this is always my concern, is how do you know? Anybody can talk. Anybody can make statements, but how do you know? So we must know the sources. Now, some of you are listening. You might be online listening, and you may have you can check whatever sources you want to check to see the 5 books that Dr. King wrote. Now, many people, when I actually do an exercise, I ask them to write down the books that Dr. King himself wrote. write those books down, and very few people have ever been able to list the five books that Dr. King wrote. They don't know. And it doesn't matter what source they go to. We give them the opportunity to go to the sources, either the net or any other source they may have to try to get those five books. And sometimes people do a reasonable job, but they list books in that, they put books in the list that are definitely not a part of the five. So that's important to know. First of all, what were the books that Dr. King wrote? And that's the first question. Because if we don't know what his books were and his thoughts and what he had to say, then how could we really have an intelligent discussion or even, a disagreement, for that matter, a disagreement about what Dr. King actually, what he said. So we have to be careful there. All right, so anyway, the first book by Dr. King is Stride Towards Freedom. Now, he wrote this book right after the Montgomery bus boycott. This was a successful boycott that lasted about 381 days, just over a year, where the black people in Montgomery, where King was living at the time, decided to challenge the white supremacist Jim Crow system in the city of Montgomery. And this, again, this is the Jim Crow era. This is the era of strict racial segregation in America and the unmitigated violence against black citizens. This is what was happening in Jim Crow America. And so the challenge was to make it so that no longer could a city of Montgomery profit from black people going onto a city bus, paying their dime, and then have to physically get off of the bus and then enter from the rear, from the back of the bus and sit in the back. So they decided to challenge that. It was the great Edie Nixon of the NAACP and Joanne Robinson of the Women's Political Council who organized a boycott after the arrest of Rosa Parks. And so they decided that they would not spend any more money on a racist anti-black system, and that's what led to the Montgomery bus boycott. People know about Rosa Parks, but they don't know about the political organization that was already set up before the Parks arrest. So there's many sources to look at that, like the women who started the Montgomery bus boycott. Check that book out, and you'll get information. Also, My Soul is Rested, and there's other sources that interviewed the people who were involved at the time, and that's important because of the fact that we can get the real evidence and not think that it was one individual that saved Montgomery and by herself started a movement. She did not. She was already a part of a political organization as the legal secretary. Anyway, in that movement, this is when King emerged in Montgomery, and so they had a successful boycott where they were able to have 99% of the people apply with their call to boycott the racist Montgomery bus system, and that began to break down the Jim Crow racial segregation system in Montgomery. So black people had to sit on the back of the bus. It was illegal for black people to go into hotels, motels, restaurants, and the public parks. It was illegal for black people to ride a Greyhound bus from one state to the next. All of these things, and they couldn't vote. The vast majority of people, black people, could not vote in the South. So much for American democracy. So here you have a movement that started with the boycott in December of 55, and it was successful for a year, and they were successful in their demands. King emerged as a leader, and this became national and eventually international news. King then later wrote his book to explain what happened in Montgomery. Stride Towards Freedom is the first text. After this, he writes Why We Can't Wait. This is the second book that he wrote, not somebody else. Forget about what others have said about King for a minute. Let's look at the record. What did he say? He wrote why We Can't Wait, because as King was being called to different places throughout the South to help black communities across the South struggle against a vicious anti-black Jim Crow system of racism and white supremacy, Dr. King Organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC, they organized, along with other organizations, along with the NAACP, along with CORE, the Congress of Racial Equality, along with SNCC, when it developed as well, the Student Nonviolent Coordinating Committee. And as these organizations were working, King was always being called in to help, because as King moved about, so did the media. So if there was grassroots organizing taking place, the goal was to to bring in King at some time, at some point, or the SCLC, if they were not already in those areas, to help bring national attention. And that would take place because the media, the news media, followed Dr. King. So many of the white supremacist and racists said that Dr. King was doing nothing but causing trouble, that the man would come into a city, come into a town, come into an area and cause trouble. The white supremacists, their position, and these are good old white folks, these are not people who are simply part of the KKK, because the system of American racism was deeply embedded into the structure of the country, which I'll indicate later that King always said this, that he said that racism was as native as the pine trees, the sagebrush, and the buffalo grass, that racism is so endemic in America that today it lightly burdens the conscience. People don't even think about it anymore because it's always been there. Even though this system was vicious, it's been a part of the American landscape since the founding of the nation, and King always reminded his readers and listeners of that reality. So the people said that King was doing nothing but causing problems. So you had people, white people in these areas, that criticized King. They said, you know what, why don't you let time solve the problem rather than coming in causing conflict that doesn't exist. And black people, or as they call them, Negroes, are content. They like their situation. So why is it that you come in and you're doing nothing but cause problems? So don't cause any problems. Just let time solve the problem. And King said, look, time is neutral. It can be used effectively or ineffectively. The problem that in America is that time is used ineffectively, and that time is used effectively by those of ill will. But those of goodwill, these are ones that have used time ineffectively. So this is why he wrote his book, is that why we can't wait, to challenge that idea. Another book, remember, he's a minister. He's a minister, he's a reverend, and so his third text is Strength to Love. Strength to Love. And he's a minister. So, yes, he talks about morality and love. That's his message. That's his original message. But as he goes along, he finds out that the problem is that you can't go up against a powerful system with just talking about love and morality. That was his first idea, to talk about moral issues. So he writes Strength to Love, and in doing so, he begins to recognize that you don't solve problems in that way. He began to recognize that moral issues don't change America. He began to understand it was structural problems that had to be addressed. Now, the fourth text that Dr. King wrote is Trumpet of Conscience. He gave a series of lectures up in Canada back in 67. Towards the end of his life, he gives a series of lectures that he then edits into a book called A Trumpet of Conscience. In his last book, the last book by Dr. King, it states his ideas, his political philosophy at the time, what he thought needed to be done. And this is a book entitled, Where Do We Go From Here? Chaos or Community? These are the five texts, the five works written by Dr. King. And most people have not read any of them. And even fewer, of course, have read all five of them. Now, what people tend to do, we asked in one of the books, they tend to add other books to the list, and they think that Dr. King wrote some other books. Well, let's address that. That really has to be addressed because of the fact that he did not. Dr. King did not write more than these five books. Yes, he wrote a lot of essays. He wrote articles. There were tons of interviews, but some of the books on the list that are out there, if you check the internet, they're not written by King. These are books written by other people. So we always have to be careful if we're looking at what somebody wrote versus what someone has written about them. They're not the same. Only you can really tell your story and not somebody else. So let me look at it. Let's address briefly, before we look more carefully at Dr. King's political philosophy, let's take a look at the books that would tend to show up on a list, and then I'll move forward and we'll look at the themes, the political themes in Dr. King's life, and these themes that are central to his work over the years from 1956 to 68 his assassination. Now, some of the books that have gotten a lot of play, a lot of focus, are books written by authors outside of the black community who have done nothing and who did nothing during the time of the black liberation struggle in the 1950s and 60s and early 70s. These are men on the outside who, when the coast was clear, later came about to write an account of what happened, but they were not activists. So these are outsiders giving comments and doing research after the fact. That's not always bad, but it is curious that men who had an opportunity to participate in a vast movement decided not to, and then later becomes the so-called experts in telling the public what happened. This is always a curious thing when we have to look, when we look at this. So we can look at books, for example, by Taylor Branch. When I was working on my master's thesis, The Revolutionary Martin Luther King, Taylor Branch was just finishing his book. We both were in Baltimore, and his book is called Parting the Waters. And Parting the Waters is a 1,000-page book, and he's subsequently written a couple of other editions of this book, three volumes, dealing with Dr. King's work. And so I had asked Taylor Branch, and he was on Morgan State University's radio station. You mentioned a few things about Dr. King, Mr. Branch, but you've left out some key elements. I'd like to know what you think about the shift that Dr. King makes and that he calls for his followers making in at the end of 1965 when the Voting Rights Bill was passed. When he emerged in 1966 in the second phase of the struggle, what is your thoughts about that, Mr. Branch? He said, I'm not aware of any shift or any change that he made. I said, how can that be when you've written a 1,000-page book, and which later the man received a Pulitzer Prize for his work. I said, you've been to the archives, you've interviewed numerous activists at the time working with King and around King. How can you be unaware of the radical shift he makes after 1965? I said, it's very clear. So what shift? I said, the shift that King talks about from civil rights to human rights, the shift that he talks about to now dealing with national and international issues. I said, when he goes to Chicago, he makes it clear that he's looking at a global reality, not just the problem of black people in the South. So you're not aware of that, Mr. Branch? Oh, no. So he claims that he wanted to get my phone number so we can dialogue. It's been 30 years now. It's been more than 20 years, and I've never received that phone call. Later, Branch was at Morgan State University giving a comparison between Malcolm and Martin, or a contrast, and I stood up and said that, you know, Mr. Branch, the more you talk, the more obvious it is that you don't know anything about Dr. King. And certainly you know far less about Malcolm X, given the comments you've made here tonight. And he was gracious enough to avoid dealing with that, but that's the reality. So anyway, you look at Branch's work, and he lived in Atlanta. Here's one of the things that's very interesting. Mr. Taylor Branch lived in Atlanta, and that was the headquarters of Dr. King, his organization, the Southern Christian Leadership Conference. And King was the president of that organization that was founded in 1957, just after the boycott was over, and now he had international attention. King and other ministers, black ministers in the South, they joined and formed the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, or the SCLC, and King, you know, he uses that organization as the basis for his work, and it's interesting to see the shift of the SCLC. But it was interesting, though, to see that you know, so much deference today has been given to Taylor Branch, when in fact he lived in Atlanta, along with Dr. King, who lived in Atlanta. That was the headquarters of the SCLC, and Taylor Branch has said that he never met Dr. King because of disinterest in the movement. How can he be disinterested when you have people across the black community? You have millions of victims who were living in America without basic rights, even in the city of Atlanta, Georgia, and a man who later is considered the expert on that period, had no interest in the plight of other human beings in his own city. Now he gets the accolades as if he's the one who's responsible for the change. No, he's not. So So there's many inaccuracies because Taylor Branch, he misses the key shifts in King's life. He misses the key information. And if you have a lack of knowledge, you can do that. But also if you have an agenda to present a popular image of King, yes, you're going to leave out the critical things that I'm going to share on the program today. We'll share that in just a minute. But Branch misses that. And then another book that people might come up with, and I would caution them about it, even though you can get some useful information, that is David Garrell's Bearing the Cross. Here you have a 700-page book that also won a Pulitzer Prize. And David Garrell seems to be quite thorough in his examination of Dr. King's work, because David Garrell will refer to a speech, for example, in his book, and he'll have a whole page or three-quarters of a page summarizing the speech, the, you know, why King went into that particular city, what local leaders and organizations he was working with, and some of the key points in his speech. And if you follow the footnotes of David Garrell, you see that he's got the footnote of that speech and how you can get it in the archive where he gave it. But in the summary, he actually quotes some of the texts of King. So the vast majority of people would think that David Garrell is very thorough in his treatment of King. However, in reading Garrell, I learned that that was not the case at all. He's thorough only to a degree, because I learned from David Garrell's work, which had been published a few years before I started my master's thesis on the revolutionary Martin Luther King, that in following all of his footnotes and getting the speeches, the actual speeches and writings of King, that David Garrell systematically left out key statements in his speeches that would overturn the popular view of King. Whenever King makes a reference to supporting liberation movements, armed liberation movements on the African continent, those seem to be missing consistently from the quotes of David Garrell. So it's interesting that he left out, using those three dots, the ellipsis marks, he leaves out what's convenient systematically. And then something else very curious about the work of David Garrell, while it is comprehensive on the one hand, again, this is a 700-page book. On the other hand, there's a glaring omission, because I learned from reading David Garrell's book that he makes an interesting statement that the biggest file, this is Garrell writing, the biggest file that you'll find that Dr. King kept was a file on Africa. And he leaves it at that. He doesn't go into what all the details that file included, and then examine the content of the file. He doesn't do that. So here's the contradiction. If Dr. King's greatest interest was on the happenings, the political dealings in Africa, and the movement against colonization, so it was a decolonization movement that had gained great momentum in Africa in the 1950s and 60s, as African countries were becoming independent from European colonial rule, as the African continents and the activists and revolutionaries were gaining their land and their countries back, as was being done in the U.S., as black people making progress against Jim Crow America, Dr. King saw a critical link between the struggle on the African continent and the struggle here in the U.S. He says that these are the same struggle. Just quoting King, this is the same struggle that at root they're fighting against white, this is him, white supremacy and the contempt for life. This is what Dr. King says, and that's why he's so enamored. This is why he's so driven. He's so drawn to what's happening on the African continent. Garrell points out that that's Dr. King's biggest file, the file on Africa. And I go with these notes to the King Center, to the other archives, for example, the Mugger Collection at Boston University, where King did his work, PhD work, and also to the FBI headquarters in D.C. I combed through all of the records there, all the ones that have been made available through the Freedom of Information Act. But nevertheless, in going through these archives, this is before the Stanford collection here in Palo Alto, California, not far from where I'm at. That collection hadn't really been formed yet, that archive. So that's another one we can put on the list. So if you're making a list of primary sources on King, I gave you the five books. I just mentioned the archives, the King Center in Atlanta, not the Public Visitor Center, but upstairs where the archive is. Then there's the Mugler collection, a special collection dealing with the King papers. Then there's the FBI headquarters, which is an indispensable part of the record, the story of Dr. King. Then you have the King Center, the King papers in Stanford, which I'll talk about in a minute because there's problems there. There are problems. And so you list these. So if you list all of these, there should be nine sources if we include the books that King wrote. And then the tenth source is a testament of hope that must be put on any list of primary or first-hand sources on King. But nevertheless, I use the notes from Garrow's work. I go to the archives, and sure enough, he was correct, that King was in constant contact with revolutionaries on the African continent who were fighting armed liberation struggles against Western powers. And never did King, privately or publicly, in any writing, any sermon, any speech, any letter, ever, anything, did he ever say anything negative about anybody fighting an armed liberation struggle to become independent. He felt that these were the children of God who were fighting against old systems of exploitation and oppression. This is what he says, then that we should support these revolutions. He didn't say we should support them if they put down their weapons. No, we should support them because these are barefoot and shirtless people rising up. And he says this publicly. And so he's in constant contact with revolutionaries in South Africa, in Zimbabwe, in Kenya. And he's encouraging them. He's in touch with them. They're in touch with him. He's in touch with them. They're in contact. In fact, in 57, when Ghana becomes independent from British rule in March of 1957, Dr. King was at the inauguration of Kwame Nkrumah as the first president of independent Ghana. And so that is King's. He's always in touch there. So the African Freedom Day celebrations that took place annually, Dr. King was at all of them. He's constantly participating in the African Freedom Day celebrations, which later became African Liberation Day, as we call it now, African Liberation Day, which today has lost some of its energy and focus because now you have African countries that are independent. They have been liberated from colonial powers in Europe, from the British and the Germans and the French and others, so they've become independent. So the African Liberation Day movement, that the name changed from African Freedom Day, this was an important international effort by black people in the African diaspora that helped lend focus and support and resources to their brothers and sisters who were struggling to free their homeland. And King had always been a part of that. How can any biography, how can any political assessment of King leave out what he was most concerned about, as Garrow does, even though he's aware that King had a major focus on the decolonization movement in Africa? So this is why these books are very problematic, because they leave out critical texts. Now, also speaking about sources, let's look at another source that is one of the most amazing that has ever been written, one of the most intriguing that's ever been written that I left off the list because it is misleading. Back in 1998, I was very surprised. This is basically a decade after I had finished my master's thesis on the revolutionary Martin Luther King, and I remember right here in Oakland, I went down to Barnes & Noble's bookstore in Jack London Square, and I'm looking to see what's new, what's the latest, and I came across an extraordinary title. I actually was stunned. I read a title of a book called The Autobiography of Martin Luther King Jr. I was stunned. I was stunned because I knew that I had conducted very thorough, systematic work by looking at all of Dr. King's works, all of his writings. I looked at his books, his essays, his sermons, his general speeches, his interviews, I looked at statements that he made, press statements and comments and addresses that he gave to his staff members at their annual retreats. I looked at the FBI records and all of the behind-the-scenes comments of King. And to find a book called The Autobiography of Martin Luther King, I was stunned because I knew that Dr. King had never, he literally had never had any intentions of writing his life story. Not did he didn't have a folder that he was putting materials in to one day write a comprehensive autobiography. He never said that that's what he wanted to do. There's no record that that's what was his intentions or on his mind. There's no records of material set aside for this. There's no record of him talking with a writer or an editor about putting his story together. Like Malcolm X, his story, he was busy as a political activist, so Alex Haley and Malcolm X had a series of meetings where Alex Haley actually penned the autobiography of Malcolm X in their scheduled meetings. And so that's the whole issue though of what was left out. It's missing chapters. But nevertheless, that's not what King had in mind. There's no record of Dr. King having an interest in writing an autobiography. So when I saw this title, The Autobiography of Martin Luther King, I was stunned. I walked away. The process of what I had saw. I didn't even test the book yet. And I looked at it because auto means self, and biography is story. The man never had an interest in writing a self-story, and I came back to the shelf and I looked at it, edited by Claiborne Carson. This is the man who was editing the King papers at Stanford University. So he has the doc, because Coretta Scott King, the late Coretta Scott King, the wife of Dr. King, who headed the King Center in Atlanta, commissioned with Claiborne Carson to write the autobiography of Martin Luther King. So they get together and decided they were going to write this man's autobiography 30 years after the man was dead, after he was assassinated. How could you write somebody else's personal life story? This is impossible. You can write a biography, a story about someone, or you can say the selected works, the selected writings of a person, but you can't write their autobiography. And so Claiborne Carson, a noted scholar at Stanford, violates basic academic and scholarly standards that you will title something the autobiography of someone else. This is totally impossible. And so Claiborne Carson and Coretta Scott King decided that they were going to put materials together to tell the story that they wanted to tell, which is unjust. This is improper. No one does that. This is a basic violation of academic standards and academic integrity. This is why I was stunned by it. I would say there's no way I could have missed such a major project. And I didn't, because when I looked through it, Mr. Carson explains his justification for calling it that. Why not call it the authorized biography of King? I don't think a person would have an issue with that, but to call it the autobiography is deliberately misleading. Now, let me share with you why the book is problematic. Not only the title, which is totally misleading. I'm sure King himself would have to have a problem with this, because there are King writings and speeches that he produced that are left out. So let me give you an example of why this is a problem. Because if I was going to choose to be disingenuous and to create Dr. King's autobiography, which is an amazing process, I would have put in material that were more comprehensive than what Claiborne Carson did, because every editor is selective. They have their own view of what should go in, what should be taken out, what should be altered, what should be changed. If you do that, then you're not writing somebody else's. How are you going to write somebody else's autobiography? So let me point out a few issues here. Because remember, documentation beats conversation, and I want you, the public, to know that this is a systematic attempt to misrepresent King, and it's at every level. This is a scholarly level, and we'll get to some of the more popular things that are presented through the media, the Eye of a Dream speech, and other things that are distorted, that are left out, that are improper. Okay, looking at this so-called autobiography of Martin Luther King, edited by Mr. Claiborne Carson. Here's what he does. Dr. King wrote 5 books. I gave you those titles. Claiborne Carson decided that he would take materials from the main 3 books. strive towards freedom, why we can't wait, and where do we go from here? He decided to leave out the materials from two of Dr. King's books. Why? Why would you leave out Strength to Love when he's a minister? That's part of his ideas. He's using the biblical text, by the way. You look at Dr. King's sermons. He's using the biblical text to give insight to the congregation of how the biblical text is a key source to really look at how the mountains will be made low. And how those high places will be made low and those valleys will become mountains. When he's talking about that, King is talking about the political climate in which those people have been oppressed, those people at the bottom of society, the people of color, that these people will rise up and at some point form a more high position, a more lofty position. This is why he's always making biblical analogy, but it's not just abstract biblical conversation. This is political thought as well in his sermons. But yet Mr. Carson decides to leave out Strength to Love. This is not proper. This is Dr. King's. He decided to take the sermons and use and put this in a book. How is that left out? Dr. King's talking about the three dimensions of a complete life and so many other things. Why is that left out? It's left out because Mr. Carson decided to leave it out. But yet it's called his autobiography. That's not everything that King says in Mr. Carson's book. He also leaves out the trumpet of conscience. Here's a series of lectures King gave in Canada in the last 6 months of his life. How is that left out? This is some of his political thought. Dr. King is talking about the up-and-coming Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C., and why he thought that that was a last desperate attempt for nonviolence, quote-unquote. Dr. King said it was a showdown for nonviolence. Why is that left out? The trumpet of conscience. So he leaves out two of the texts. Not only that, here's some other things that are left out. Claiborne Carson does have a section on black power, because King talked about it, he wrote about it, but what he left out is interesting. He left out an essay that Dr. King wrote called Black Power Defined. Here's a whole essay that King wrote explaining how black power should be implemented in the political arena, in the economic arena, in the social arena, that black power, how it would work, with working with the labor movement. But yet Mr. Carson leaves that out. He takes a section from King's last book on the black power and in King's ideas, which is fine, but yet Mr. Carson leaves out black power a whole essay. This is not just. Here's some other things that he leaves out. Dr. King, on March 31st, 1968, this is just about 4 days before he's assassinated, Dr. King gave a speech called Remain Awake Through a Great Revolution. This is a speech that King gives. He's assassinated now April 4th. Of 68. He gives this speech March 31st of 68, Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. What was he talks about this story of Rip Van Winkle, who goes to sleep, and the man sleeps for 20 years. And when he wakes up, there's a new leader. He goes to sleep, and King George III is in control of the American colonies. The man wakes up 20 years later, and there's a brand new president, George Washington. So King said Remaining Awake Through a Great Revolution. He said it was a revolution in three areas. It was a technological revolution, which we can definitely verify today. There was secondly a revolution in weaponry, in arms, and we can verify that now with the smart bombs that the U.S. has and so forth, computer-generated killing machines. And the third area is, this is critical, the human rights revolution. Why is this left out? The human rights revolution, this is what King was focused on in the second period of his life that emerged. The second stage of his political career that begins in January of 1966. He's talking from that point on consistently about not the civil rights movement, but the human rights movement, the human rights revolution, because the civil rights phase was done. King had moved on because the basic civil rights had already been achieved, at least legally. So the Civil Rights Bill had been passed in 64. The Voting Rights Bill had been passed in 1965. When that Voting Rights Bill was passed in 1965, Dr. King made it clear to his staff members in the SCLC and people in general that he spoke to, that in a, he said to his staff, in a sense, Congress has, I'm quoting him, has signed the civil rights movement out of existence. What he meant is that the U.S. Congress, when it signed the voting rights bill, it gave black people the at least the legal right to vote. The civil rights movement is over because those goals have been accomplished. Now the goal is to deal with what he said was human rights. Why is that left out? In fact, if you look at Claiborne Carson's autobiography of Dr. King, you can look at the index and there's nothing, literally nothing, on human rights. It's completely omitted. The term is not even there to show you that this is a distortion of King. How is that left out? You have a great political speech the last week of his life and is left out. Here's, so that's the speech. Look at what, like the essays that are left out. The book called A Testament of Hope, edited by James Washington. Now, this text, I can see why he actually calls it A Testament of Hope. It's not a bad title for the book, A Testament of Hope. He calls the subtitle The Essential Writings of Martin Luther King Jr. It's not just writings, it's speeches as well, but nevertheless, it's a very good public book dealing with King's political career from 1956 to 68. Nevertheless, look at the essay of Testament of Hope. It blows away what most people think they know about King, and this is left out of the autobiography of King. By the way, this is the last essay he wrote. This essay of Testament of Hope was published posthumously. It was published after Dr. King was already assassinated. This is the man's latest thoughts, his latest ideas. So clearly this would go into any legitimate so-called autobiography. It would have to. This is the latest thought. Dr. King mentioned in the essay that that America is deep. This is what he comments on consistently in this essay, that America is deeply racist and that the American democracy, this is quoting King, is deeply flawed both economically and socially. Let me repeat that, that America is deeply racist and the democracy is deeply flawed both economically and socially. So for King, do you have a government structure, a system that is flawed at the core? And this is what he learns when he recognizes that it's not going to be moral issues or local concerns or simple protests or looking at a little reform or talking about an abstract dream that was going to change America. He recognized that. So he's challenging the very structure of the country. He says that in this essay that there had to be a radical structural change, that the whole structure of the country is flawed, that it's at the core it is corrupt. And this is why he begins to criticize the government, to criticize Congress without hesitation or reservation. He said that the Congress was running amok with racism. He says that the foreign policy was driven by racist white men who didn't respect other people. This is what he says. He also says that there was a human rights revolution taking place. This is what he's talking about in his essay, A Testament of Hope. But yet Mr. Claiborne Carson leaves that out to show you that it is improper to ever write somebody else's story. This is a story that the man himself edited and put together, and clear that Claiborne Carson never met Dr. King, didn't know anything about it. He simply became a part of the project after he was approached by Coretta Scott King and the King Center to house the King documents there and to put together the King papers. So this is different. And if you're not a part of the movement and a part of those organizations that represent a continuance of the movement, then you're going to be limited. This is why I can say that not only have I done the work in the archives and looked at all of the documents of King, but also working with people, some of the greatest activists of that time. For example, Kwame Ture and his organization, the All African People's Revolutionary Party, been an active member in Baltimore. So I got the inside scoop of these things. And talking about the Black Power movement and King's association with and having dialogues and conversations and meetings with the great Kwame Ture, because I was a member of the organization. Of course, his name was changed from Stokely Carmichael to Kwame Ture. And so so it's not just some academic approach, but looking at the activists and what they had to say as well. So not only that, but Dr. King, this is interesting too, and to show you why this essay should never be left out, A Testament of Hope, he's not only talking about the human rights revolution, but he also is, you know, he has a lot of advice for people like Obama and others, things that they don't consider. But he consistently talks about the structural change and that the and that he's and look, King talks about the interrelated flaws, the structural problem is a part of it, but the flaws in America. So he deals with the triplets of racism, poverty, and militarism. And he consistently talks about these things, the systematic flaws that would have to lead to a radical reconstruction of the whole system. This is why King became a pronounced threat to the U.S. government. Not only that, but it's important to know that Dr. King always had problems with politicians. And people have falsely given credit to John F. Kennedy for signing the Civil Rights Bill, and then Lyndon Johnson, who became president after Kennedy was assassinated, for signing the Voting Rights Bill. King criticized that. He says no president, this is what he says in his essay, A Testament of Hope. No president has really done very much for the American Negro. No president. So he's not praising anybody. He recognizes that it is black people themselves that force presidents, that force politicians to make changes in order to save or advance their own political career. So he says no president has really done very much for the American Negro, though the past two presidents have received much undeserved credit for helping us. This credit has accrued to Lyndon Johnson and John Kennedy only because it was during their administration that Negroes began doing more for themselves. Kennedy didn't voluntarily submit a civil rights bill, nor did Lyndon Johnson. In fact, both told us at one time that such legislation was impossible. This is what King talks about. Also know this, that Dr. King didn't trust Kennedy because he understood that Kennedy was first, what, a politician. And the politicians do what's best to save or help their political career. Keep in mind when the March on Washington took place, when Dr. King gives the so-called I Have a Dream speech, the president was John F. Kennedy. Yet there was 250,000 people in D.C. On the mall, the mall there to protest for civil rights. If John Kennedy was such a great civil rights president, then why is it that people are demonstrating during his administration? King understood, as others did, that Kennedy was against it. Kennedy didn't want the demonstration. He couldn't, but when he found out he couldn't prevent it, then later, after this great demonstration takes place, is captured by the news media that goes out to the world, then of course, and then there's still attacks on black people. After King gives a speech, he understood that the speech wasn't just to go to D.C. and talk about some distant dream. No, the speech was to really challenge the American government to give basic rights to black people. So it was that August of 1963 event that led to the 60, among other things, that led to the 1964 Civil Rights Bill. And it's not Kennedy and some great leadership, not at all. So this is why he's criticizing these people. He didn't trust them. He said that you can't trust the Kennedys. And this is why he never publicly came out or even privately and advocated for the voting of these individuals. Not at all. But anyway, this essay is left out. So this is the problem with these kind of books written by other people, because they're always going to contain distortions. And shame on anybody for writing the, quote, autobiography of Dr. King and contributing to the great misrepresentation and distortions here of King. Now, look, let me share a few other things about King's political ideas, his philosophy, so we can bust some other myths here. And then we'll open up the phone line shortly for those that might want to call if you have any questions. But if we're going to look at King, there's several things we have to look at. That he became a pronounced threat to the American government, particularly when the FBI organized a Get King campaign starting in 1962. They recognized that Dr. King had growing national and international influence and credibility, and the FBI couldn't stop that. What they did do is record what was taking place, and they tried to intervene at some point. But we have to look at that the real King that emerged, because even if somebody wanted to lock him in to the I Have a Dream speech, they totally don't understand. He had given the speech earlier in Detroit, and no one wrote that speech for him. Stanley Livingston or nobody else told King what to do. That doesn't make any sense. Levinson and others were simply advisors. King stayed up until the early hours of the morning before August 28, 1963, finishing that speech. And most people don't know, because the media misrepresents King, why they were even in Washington, D.C. He says, "I'm happy to join with you today in what will go down in history as the greatest demonstration for freedom in the history of our nation." That's how he starts the speech out. But yet we don't get any of the first part of the 16-minute speech. We get the last few couple minutes where he's talking about a dream. But he's in D.C. with thousands of others to talk about the American reality, the American nightmare. And that's what he was there to do, is to criticize what America had continued to do in America to black people. For example, that was in 1963. So he makes a reference to a document signed 100 years earlier in 1863, the Emancipation Proclamation. He said this was an interesting document, but he says that, but 100 years later, the Negro still is not free. 100 years later, the life of the Negro is still sadly crippled by the manacles of segregation and the chains of discrimination. 100 years later, the Negro lives on a lonely island of poverty in the midst of a vast ocean of material prosperity. 100 years later, the Negro is still languished in the corners of American society and finds himself in exile in his own land. So we've come here today to dramatize a shameful condition. That's why they're there. They're not there to talk about a dream. And he goes on and makes indictments, criticisms of America. He talks about the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. And, of course, this is taken out of most speeches. I've learned some years ago that when people are giving out speeches to their classes or even at their university level using books with the speech, King's speech has been carefully edited by propagandists who distort his record, his work. So they take out what they don't want. That's incendiary comments by King. They take out whatever would be offensive to them to try to sanitize the man's speech. Now, this could be done with one of the most popular men in the history of America, one of the greatest philosophers, one of the greatest thinkers, one of the most courageous men in the 20th century, one of the greatest political activists of our time. If his speech, arguably the most popular speech in the history of the country, if that can be edited and changed before the eyes of the public, what else is being left out? That's the general question. Because you can go online to just about any source you want or any written source, any books you have, and the speech is 80 to 90%. It has been edited. It's been changed. It's been altered. When he talks about, for example, that we can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. That's usually taken out, it's left out. And then towards the end, as he talks about the viciousness of America in this I Have a Dream speech, and most people wouldn't even recognize the speech if they heard the first two-thirds of it, because all we get from the media is that I had a dream. He's been frozen in this concept. But nevertheless, he's trying to give hope to those who were there, the 250,000 people in D.C. back in August of 63. If you don't leave people on a sour note, you give them hope. You give them something to do. That's what leaders do. And this is why King is saying that even with all these problems, he says this, I have a dream. And he goes on to say, and what we hear is that I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will be judged by the color of their skin and not by the content of their character. I have a dream today. So we hear that. We don't hear any of the first part of King's criticisms. And then he goes on to say this. Here's when the media, they cut off the speech. And here's what's edited, what's changed, what's left out. He then also says right after that, I have a dream that one day down in Alabama with this vicious racist, with his governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. So he says this. He's talking about the vicious racist in Alabama. That's taken out. Police brutality is taken out. The speech has been altered. You take it out. Many things have been altered. Things have been left out systematically to present King the myth and not King the man. One of his aides said that, look, let's face it, that look at what they've done to Jesus' image. If they've done that to Jesus' image, you know, the guy with blue eyes and white skin, long blonde hair, that he said if they've done that to Jesus' image, King's image didn't stand a chance. And he's right. That's exactly what has happened. But we have to look at that king in a more in-depth way. So if I was focusing on the workshop, we would have to first look at the liberation movements in Africa, Asia, and Latin America, which had a significant impact on the African-American liberation movement. And these movements drew support from Dr. King. This is why we have to look at the Africa file. They drew support. I was intrigued to learn that King was a founding and active member of the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa. And they had conventions in 1962 and one in 1964 where King helped draft a statement that they're calling for the public support of armed liberation movements. You look at these statements of the American Negro Leadership Conference on Africa, and King was a prominent member and part of this, that they called for the support of the revolutionary movements that had been taking place, armed struggle, on the African continent for years. So they praise. They say, we rejoice with those nations that have taken in place among the community of free nations. They're talking about Algeria, Morocco, Tunisia, in a bloody fight against the French to become independent. They were praising what was happening in Mozambique and Angola and Zimbabwe and Kenya. Look at these struggles. These are bloody struggles. And King publicly, without hesitation or reservation, calls for the support of these revolutionary movements. This is why it's important to know that this was taking place before he came out and called for the unconditional support of the liberation movement in Vietnam. And he condemned the U.S. government for destroying their two most cherished institutions, the family and the village. He criticized America and said that America needed to pay reparations to them. So we have to, that's one issue here, looking at the liberation movements and King's support of them. The second critical issue that we have to look at, if we're going to do a critical examination of Dr. King, is his work beginning in the second phase, as he called it. King said it was two phases. He said it was a civil rights phase, which took place when the Brown decision was given in 1954. And in other cases, he said that there you can begin this first phase of this black movement in 1955 with the Montgomery bus boycott. So the first period, the civil rights period, we can say 1954, when the Brown decision had been given by the Supreme Court that to segregate a child on the basis of race in the public school system was illegal. So that was, as King said, the legal turning point in the movement, but the psychological turning point was indeed the Montgomery bus boycott. He said nobody can ride your back unless it's bent. So he said that in this first period, from starting in 1954 up until 1965, when the Voting Rights Bill was finally passed, giving black people the legal right to vote in America, that this period, this is the civil rights period. That's what he called it. Then he says that the second period, that this will require more extensive adjustments on the part of the white majority, the white public, because they didn't have to give up anything during the civil rights period. They didn't have to give up any power, any wealth. There's no change in the relationships. So he said the second period will require a much more difficult task. He called the second period that began in 1966 the human rights period, So I'm going to take calls in about 5 minutes. We'll take calls. So caller, just hang on. We'll take calls in about five minutes, and we'll open it up. But let me put this in context here. So the human rights period begins in 1966. This is when Black Power movement emerged as well. So we have to know that. That's when King started dealing. He goes to Chicago and he deals with the human rights revolution. And he then later begins to embrace Black Power, not as a slogan, but as a program. And he's focused on community building and the acquisition of power. This is the second phase, so we have to look at that as well. So Chicago is really important because of the second phase that King embraces. And out of that second phase, we have to look at the issue of self-defense and the rise of the Black Power movement, because Dr. King was a part of that movement. And Dr. King always defended himself from the early days. He had armed men around his house in Montgomery, and even in the Black Power movement that emerged in June of 1966, Dr. King said the issue was this. It wasn't whether or not somebody should defend themselves personally when attacked. He said the issue was whether or not it was tactically wise to carry a gun and knife during a demonstration. So we have to look at that and the issue of a of self-defense and what he looked at in the domestic context regarding weapons and then internationally, because he knew that these were two different realities. People abroad were winning liberation struggles through picking up the gun, and King supported them. How do we know that? Well, it's a part of the public record. It's not even a question here about that. And then, of course, the Vietnam campaign, when King called for the American government to pay reparations and criticize them for destroying the country in Vietnam through the warfare. Let me read a couple quick things, and then I'm going to open up the lines here because there's a lot to say, and I just want you to know about King. And so here's what he's dealing with in the last part of his work. He's dealing with the issue of power. He says, black power in its broad and positive meaning is a call to black people to amass the political and economic strength to achieve their legitimate goals. He goes on to say the problem of transforming the ghetto, therefore, is a problem of power, a confrontation between the forces of power demanding change and the forces of power dedicated to preserving the status quo. We can look at his last book to get this information. Power properly understood is ability to achieve purpose. He says there's nothing essentially wrong with power. The problem is that in America, power is unequally distributed. He goes on and talks about this. He said black is beautiful and as beautiful as any other color. When we believe that, this is something very necessary. This is something very constructive and very creative. So the concept of black power is something that we are certainly able to understand and accept. So as we talk about power, we must always see power as a right use of strength. And he says that power is not the white man's birthright. It will not be legislated for us and delivered in neat government packages. It is a social force any group can utilize by accumulating its elements in a planned, deliberate campaign to organize it under its own control. And King was somebody that believed that the only way to solve the problem in America was to confront power with power. And that was the critical key here. And this is why he was the number one target of the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, and he was eventually assassinated. There's so much more that we can say regarding Dr. King, but we have to go to the record. Because if we go to the record, we'll recognize that what we think we know about King has little to do with the facts. And we'll know why the man was targeted and eventually assassinated. And we can look at the FBI's central role in the assassination of Dr. King. So there's much more to say. We have one caller. So let's see if we can get you on here. Okay, caller, you're on the air. I'm Professor Maynu M. Pim. Tell us your name and where you're calling from.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Yes, I'm Janine. I'm calling from Connecticut.
Hi.
I'm just enjoying the information and learning a lot about Dr. King, and you're doing an excellent job dispelling a lot of myths. I did have a question. How do you feel some of his colleagues after his death did to maybe perpetuate some of this mythology that we've gotten? You know, that we've been given about Dr. King. I'm talking about people like Ralph Abernathy, your Jesse Jacksons, your James Foremans, people like that. How do you see some of their roles in either helping or trying to bring about different viewpoints about King and his legacy?
Well, I appreciate that, Janine. It's an excellent question. Well, as you know, Ralph Abernathy wrote, "And the Walls Came Tumbling Down." And Ralph Abernathy was Dr. King's number one colleague within SCLC. Among all the people he worked closely with, we would have to say Ralph Abernathy was the closest to King. So his words are important. But the problem with Ralph Abernathy's book, "And the Walls Came Tumbling Down," is the fact that the book was written when Ralph Abernathy's health was in a dire situation. The man was not well. I remember seeing Ralph Abernathy on the old Phil Donahue show, and Phil Donahue asked Ralph Abernathy, are you okay? He said, oh, yeah, I'm fine. But he asked the question because it was obvious that Mr. Abernathy was not well at all. And that's right around the same time that the book had come out. And it's interesting that there's no physical way that Ralph Abernathy could have written a book, but not only that, the man's thoughts were not even clear. And yet what Ralph Abernathy did, I guess one of the big issues here is that the mainstream media and the government, they've taken focus away from King. And so what happened here is that they were criticizing King. So, oh, his PhD is not legitimate because he plagiarized. That was one big, big issue. Well, in the black community ministers, they borrow information and ideas all the time. They didn't call it plagiarism, but so people wanted the public to focus on the plagiarism of King, and the other thing, his supposed womanizing, that Dr. King had affairs outside of his marriage. Well, this information was presented by the FBI and J. Edgar Hoover, who spied on everybody's sexual life, sexual activities, and there seemed to be something wrong with Hoover. So basically, Ralph Abernathy, in his book, he addressed this issue of King womanizing, and he gives reasons for it. But it's interesting that this had never been stated before, and Ralph Abernathy, in his deteriorated state, mentions this. And so all of the records of King's so-called womanizing, this is in the National Archives. Nobody's seen the raw data. This is information that was produced and supposedly recorded by the FBI, and it's in the National Archives until the year 2025. Nobody can even see it. All we have is secondhand reports from FBI agents who, number one, had a political issue against Dr. King. They were jumping for joy in Atlanta when he was assassinated. And not only that, but everybody that's gone to the FBI records know, the headquarters, that is, they know that those records are flawed in the sense that people inaccurately report information. So, in other words, until the raw data is made available in the year 2025, we don't know. And I just say that Ralph Abernathy's comments, if he had made comments earlier in the years immediately following King's assassination, they would be more credible. But at his deteriorated state and his advanced age and the serious health problems that he had, that we have to really be cautious. And not only that, but right after that Phil Donahue show, Ralph Abernathy died in less than a year. His health was not very good. So I think he kind of perpetuated a womanizing thing that has been always the concern of the FBI. But also, you have other people on the other hand, like Wyatt Walker, working with Dr. King. Wyatt Walker has been one of those diligent individuals who have protected, tried his best, that is, to protect Dr. King's legacy. And he is as displeased as anybody, Wyatt Walker is, as the misrepresentation of King as an abstract dreamer rather than a practical activist. So there have been people like Wyatt Walker and others who have worked hard to try to free King's legacy and put it in a proper context and not allow the media and writers to continue to distort King's legacy. So, and I think James Forman's work, Making the Black Revolutionaries and others, those works are important as well because he's talking about the relationship that he and others as black power advocates had with King. And this is so important because King worked with the black power advocates, had private meetings with them, while on the other hand, leaders in the NAACP and other organizations, they were publicly condemning young people in the community who were calling for black power. King never condemned them. He said, only thing King said was, look, yes, I agree that to burn buildings in your own community is not a solution to the problem. However, this disappointment, this anger, it is not from imaginary issues. This is from real concrete issues. So we can't blame them. They're simply striking out in frustration about a country that denies them basic rights. So King shifted from criticizing the young people in the Black Power movement to embracing them, giving them legitimacy. And James Forman, he talks about this. And so does Stokely Carmichael in his book, Ready for the Revolution. So these are critical people who work with King who validate his work in the black power community, Dr. King's work. And, you know, Abernathy, as I said, you know, you have to really look at when that book was written, who worked with him, and that the man really was not as competent in those declining months as we would have liked him to be in order to write a clear book about his former colleague. So I appreciate your question, and, you know, thank you for listening. And again, I have on my website, mainnewampim.com. com. This is also a source that could be used as well, because I have a lot of essays. I have a couple essays as well as some DVDs on presentations I've done on King, going into more detail about the two political phases in King's work. This is very important. And by the way, he consistently talks about a nightmare and not a dream, and this is what's been left out as well. Okay, caller in the 313 area code, you're on the air. Please give us your name and where you're calling from. 313.
Hey, what's up? Hey, brother, Manu and Pim, can you hear me?
Yes, we can hear you.
Hey, Hotep brother, this is brother Michael Robinson from the African History Network show. How you doing, brother?
Hey, brother Hotep, all is well, brother.
All right. Actually, I just tuned in, man, just to listen. And
okay.
You have some excellent information, so I can't wait to have you on Thursday night also. But I've read your essays, I've interviewed you before, and you know, as you said before, Dr. King is probably the most misunderstood person in American history, and possibly also in African history as well. So we need to definitely, we don't need to go to our opponent to learn about our own people. We need to actually read Dr. King's own words as opposed to trying to understand him through the filter of the European media, because what they're feeding us about Dr. King is totally the antithesis of what the truth is. You know, so we definitely, you know, I was listening to some other shows today, and some of the people talking about Dr. King, you could tell they have never read any of his works. they really don't know anything about Dr. King except the I Have a Dream speech, except what they've been shown during a certain time of the year on TV. That's about it. So just, brother, keep up the good work. I don't want to take up too much time. I know that other people may have questions. But I'm glad you're doing the show today.
Well, thank you, brother. I appreciate it. Yes, sir. Yeah.
Okay.
Okay. All right, brother Michael. Yeah. Thank you. Well, that's what we're doing, folks. We're making things happen, and you know, and there's more and more people now. You know, there's more and more folks who are knowing and learning about the real Dr. King in the midst of amazing media propaganda. You know, if you look at the sports channel ESPN. You know, they have today, this is King Day. You know, this is the third Monday in every January is the King holiday. This is the 25th anniversary of the holiday. And so King Day is celebrated by having a bunch of sporting events sponsored by Budweiser. What in the world did that have to do with King's work and King's legacy? Here in San Francisco area, you have the annual train ride from, like, the San Jose area to San Francisco. So that becomes a... The respect for King's legacy for people, so people of all walks of life can ride the train or bus from San Jose to San Francisco, and that's it. And don't learn anything about the revolutionary Martin Luther King. And we should really challenge these things because people haven't read anything. Really, they literally haven't read much. And that's generally, as Brother Michael said, that's generally what happens. You have these, even when you have King events, King specials, they don't say much about anything that King was concerned about. What about his focus on the liberation struggles on the African continent? He's consistently focused on that. What about the deep racism that concerned Dr. King? And what about his relationship with the FBI? If you look at this relationship with the FBI, it's interesting that in Claiborne Carson's autobiography of Malcolm X, there's one page on the FBI. One page. It was a passing statement. This is why we really have to be careful here. Now, here's what is crucial. Here's what I suggest that people do. Get books by King that are publicly available. Get these books and read them. And look at all of what's left out. And look at where Dr. King was in 66. In 67 and 68, look at what he was focused on and where it is that he thought the nation should go. Look at his last birthday. His last birthday was a working birthday. He had breakfast with his family in Atlanta, and right after that he had a 3-hour meeting with leaders. from 10 to 1. He wasn't out. He wasn't sleeping on his birthday. And no, the man was focused on working with the labor movement and the organization of labor. King called for a Bill of Rights, for the disadvantaged, where the Congress should spend billions, literally billions of dollars, to support the poor, those that didn't have money and jobs, and that it was inexcusable to have poverty in America. This is where King was focused, and yet we don't know this. So when people talk about living the dream, what dream? King talks about a nightmare. He says, soon after I gave the speech in D.C., my dream turned into a nightmare. It turned into a nightmare where four little black girls were killed in church in Birmingham. So my dream turned into a nightmare when America sends thousands of troops over to kill innocent people. My dream turned into a nightmare when we look at the poverty in America. He focuses on the nightmare. He says, what happens to a dream? He said, defer. He said, these dreams haven't been deferred. They've been repudiated by the vicious system, by the handiwork of white society. This is what he says in regards to the dream. Right after he gives the speech, he's making criticisms of this dream idea. And yet this has been left out. It's been removed from the public. We talk about him nicely now. People, we're giving him a holiday now. But you go back to where King was, and it's clear that he was the most hated man across America. People forgotten that. He was the most hated man in America. Today he would be considered a terrorist, something else that would draw the fear of people across the country. This is why he was not only a pronounced threat to the U.S. government, but he was seen as dangerous. And people hated King in those last couple of years. If not, read the record and you'll know that, wow, things have changed. So we're going to take one other call here. 917, you're on the line. Please give us your name and where you're calling from.
I'm calling from New York. I'm Deirdre. I'm not going to stay on long. I wanted to say that even though today is his holiday, it's amazing how many offices are open and how many companies still don't respect the holiday.
Okay, you're right. You're right. Absolutely right. That's.
And I know he did more for this country than most, and he should be respected by everyone. And it's not just a black holiday as many people look at it.
That's an excellent point. Yeah, it's definitely an excellent point. And you're right. Many things are still open, and it's not the same level of respect. And in those places that are celebrating King, I mean, it's like, well, what are they really celebrating here? The dream. And yet you have vast poverty across America.
Many in white America, as I said, assume it's only a black holiday for black people to take off, and that is so wrong. But
yeah,
I see you have other callers, so I'm not going to stay on, but I was just making that comment.
Well, thank you, Deirdre, for that comment. That's an excellent comment because of the fact that that's the reality. You know, people just, it's a day off. For some and for others, it's it's just a holiday for somebody else, and that's the shame. And you know, if you go to the King Center in Atlanta, you go to the King Center for Nonviolent Social Change, and you go to the Visitor Center. That's the video, unless they've changed it recently. But that's the video where they have the official making of the King holiday back in 1986. So it's been 25 years. And that's what's presented. It would be very useful to present other King ideas, other King speeches, rather than just they have portions of I Have a Dream speech that play, and then the making of the holiday. So, yes, people think in a very limited way about King's impact, but clearly he had a major impact. It is not just King, it's the organization around him. And by the way, King didn't create the movement created King. King wasn't even interested in becoming a political activist, not at the age of 26. The man was drawn into the movement because of the need. He didn't become comfortable with being a national and eventually an international figure until later. He said that, look, you know, at some point you begin to accept your role. You begin to accept your situation. And he eventually understood that he was a world historical figure and that only he could fulfill his role and his mission at the time. It took him years to get to that point. And he had like an epiphany. at some point. He used a term quite often called the zeitgeist, which means the spirit of the times, and he felt it was a revolutionary spirit sweeping the world, and that he was a particular person that had a particular role at a particular time, and that's why at some point he became absolutely committed to changing the landscape of America, and that's why he became so dangerous to the government. But in 66 and 67, there were no major victories for Dr. King. The civil rights campaign and that focus was over. Now he's dealing with the more critical issues that went to the core of America, and that was to confront power with power. This is why he's focused on organizing black people, number one, and then on a larger level, organizing the poor, organizing supporters of the black struggle. And this is what King was focused on with the Poor People's Campaign in Washington, D.C. He felt that was a showdown for nonviolence. He said it was a last desperate attempt for nonviolence, but he never got a chance to participate in this struggle where there would be thousands of people who in a very slow march would go to D.C., that these people would camp in D.C. They would set up tents, and they would stop all vehicular traffic. They would stop all foot traffic. They had plans to call all of the D.C. main offices and tie up all the phone lines, so it would be no business as usual. And so J. Edgar Hoover was leaking, as usual, information to the press that Dr. King's irresponsible. He's going to create a bloodbath in D.C., and blood's going to be on his hands. We can't allow him to be so irresponsible. And this is what was presented by mainstream media contacts who were taking the FBI story as is, verbatim, and running that propaganda in the press. So when King was in Memphis, the FBI created a scenario. They created a scenario to make sure that Dr. King was villainized. So the FBI hired some thugs, the invaders, gang members, to bust up the march that Dr. King was leading, to bust up store windows and cars, and they were paid to disrupt the march. And then by the FBI, and the FBI didn't leak the stories to say that Dr. King was irresponsible, that he couldn't even lead a demonstration, and tried to eliminate his credibility. So the FBI lured King into a place from the Holiday Inn to the Lorraine Motel, and they lured him from the bottom floor of that motel to the upper floor, where he was eventually assassinated in front of. Because the FBI leaked stories to say this man is calling for the black community to boycott a place, but yet he himself is sleeping in a nice Holiday Inn. They made him move to the Lorraine Motel. So anyway, these are issues about King and the assassination that we need to know. So we'll cover this on another program. But this has been Africana Studies with Professor Maynu and Pim, and hopefully you'll go to the records to learn more about the revolutionary Dr. King and my website, maynuandpim.com. So until now, we will reach you with Hotep, and again, we'll talk about King in a later time, probably around his assassination on April 4th, because we must shift from his birthday in January to his death day in April. That raises a whole other set of questions of what is it that the man was killed for. It is uncomfortable to look at Dr. King, who was killed by a high-powered rifle that severed his spine, and him now died in a pool of his own blood. That's a very uncomfortable image, as opposed to a cuddly black baby who was born in Atlanta. So that's a very uncomfortable image to shift from the birthday to the death day, but that's what it would take in order to really understand the political work of Dr. King and why the FBI was so fascinated in destroying King, and then afterwards for people around him and historians and others to distort the man's legacy, because they know that there would be those in privilege and power that have to give up what they've gained through exploiting black people and others if people continue with the legacy of Dr. King. So we will revisit this issue. So join me also on Facebook, maynuandpim.com, and we'll continue the dialogue.
Broadcasting to the world, broadcasting to the world, to the world, to the world.